You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 249. Back to the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile. We got a mega jam-packed episode today. We got, count them, four people on tonight's podcast. You say, John, you always have three people on the podcast. Why do you have four people on the podcast tonight? The answer is because Adam White's wife just gave birth to Adam White's baby. It's a healthy little boy. Everybody's happy and healthy. And so we're all pleased about that. So congrats to Adam White. So he's not here because he is sleep-deprived and caring for a newborn. Hopefully he will be back next week. So I couldn't just bring in one person to replace Adam. I had to bring in multiple. So with us tonight, first of all, is the guy that goes over every single little letter at Punk News, the guy that corrects all of my horrible typos that are in every sentence that I type out. We are here with news editor, copy editor, reviews editor, Adam Eisenberg. Adam Eisenberg, what's happening down there in Florida?
It's getting real hot. Like real hot, like 90s and 127% humidity. It's bad. Ugh.
Do you ever go down to like the Miami party scene and stuff? Like, have you ever gotten involved in that or gone down there and see what the deal is?
I have not really been involved in the Miami party scene. I am I am familiar with it though. From like I worked in the features department for a number of years doing like entertainment coverage, so I'm very well aware of it, but not really involved in it. No, it's one, out of my price range, and two, you have to dress way too nicely.
So you're the Jane Goodall of the Miami party scene. You report from afar but don't interact.
That is fair. That's accurate enough that I'll accept it.
And we are
lives amongst them.
and that guy talking right there, this guy is the Jane Goodall of the youth of today. We are here with Greg DeSimp, podcast editor. Greg, are you on summer break? Or are you still teaching the kids how to blow on those tubas?
Well, I don't teach beginning band anymore. But nevertheless, no, I still go until last student day is May 27th. And then teachers have some extra bullshit.
Wait, you don't teach? Well, what do you teach then?
I did teach beginning band and orchestra, but I teach kindergarten to fifth grade, what they call general music. So, like, they go to music,
yeah.
You know, with their class, yeah.
Do you teach recorders? Mm-hmm. Do you guys play recorders?
Fuck yeah, fourth graders.
Why is a recorder called a recorder? That never made any sense to me.
You know, the history of the recorder, I mean, it predates the flute. I really don't know how it got that exact name, but the flute basically replaced it, and it came back as almost like a toy instrument, I suppose, because it's easy to learn.
That was actually,
I'll look into it.
I never really liked music class when I was in the elementary school, but I did enjoy playing the recorder. Adam Eisenberg, did you enjoy playing the recorder back in elementary school?
I had a series of really bad music teachers.
Really?
Mrs. Cunningham, most notably. And
I'll never forgive her.
And so while I did play the violin in orchestra in third and fourth grade, and I did play the recorder, I don't remember them being particularly happy times.
Mm. Oh.
And then also here with us is basically everyone's favorite podcast person, everyone's favorite podcast personality, Tricky Ricky Frankel out there in California. Tricky Ricky down there in the L.A. party scene. Ricky, what's happening in the L.A. party scene this week?
Greetings and Baba Booey to you, John.
You know, I got to say, Ricky, on a professional scale, I'm about at a 9. But on a personal level, I'm about at a 2.
Oh, Debbie.
Debbie. Yeah. Only if you listeners out there get those references, then you're okay with us.
Yeah. No, you know what? It's not as hot as it sounds like it is in Florida, but it'll get there later in like probably.
I'm not asking about the weather,
weeks.
Ricky. I'm saying the party scene.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What's the party scene like down there in L.A.?
You know, no, there's no parties in the Valley.
What are you talking about? All people do in L.A. is party.
Not in the Valley. That's all in Hollywood. in Malibu and Santa Monica.
In the valley, they just film porn. Right?
Exactly. Yeah, it is the porn capital of the world.
It's like a kind of party.
but basically, if you watch the show Entourage and you hear them bashing the valley, you'll see all the parties in that show are over the hill in Malibu and Hollywood.
Well, Ricky, man, you should head on over and see what's happening.
That's where I go to all the punk shows are in Hollywood and downtown and all those places. So I'm usually there on the weekends.
Do you wear a boot with a handkerchief tied around your boot and a dangly left earring?
I will not do that out of respect for myself. No.
So anyways, this is episode 249. Listen, people, we got a jam-packed episode this week, but next week, be sure to tune in. It will be episode 250. That's right, episode 250. We don't have everything squared away yet, but if you remember, podcast 200 was a blowout where we had a bunch of musicians, and basically it was just almost all music and a couple of other things. We were thinking about doing that this time, but if we do like a huge blowout every 50 episodes, that's less than once a year, it doesn't seem that special, and I want the blowouts to be special. So what we're going to do on the 50s, on 250, on 350, we're going to do the exact opposite. We're just going to do a chill-out episode on 250, and we're going to have you guys call in, so you'll be able to call in next Wednesday at 9:30 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. You can call in and just bullshit with us. We'll have a couple of things, maybe a few musical guests, but it should be a really fun episode. It'll be live, and we're going to have a bunch of the editors and staff on it, and it should be a good time. So you'll be able to call in at 9:30 next Wednesday live, 9:30 to 10:30 p.m. on next Wednesday. And also today, as we promised a couple of weeks ago, we've got an interview with the curator and owner of Amnesia Rock Fest. So be sure to stick around to the end of the episode where I interview the curator of Amnesia Rock Fest and ask him about the time that he went to Disney World with Tim Armstrong. So you can check that out. So let's crack open some mail. We've got a lot of mail this week. If you haven't listened to last week's episode, you definitely should. It's one of our greatest episodes, if you ask me. I'm not gonna summarize the whole thing because you kind of just need to listen to it. But basically, in episode 249, I talked about my conflict with Ben Weasel and the interview that didn't happen with him. Adam White talks about a mysterious band that was extremely rude to one of our staff members that took news from a public social media website. And Tricky Ricky basically talked about how much he hates Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, it was a lot of yelling in that episode.
And so you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. The first one we got is from Jason. I've had my conflict with Jason in the past, but maybe I will maybe I'll change my position. Maybe I'm not giving him enough credit. This is from Jason. Jason says, just listening to episode 248, which is maybe the best episode ever, and even though I've been accused of being a troll and anti-John G, I gotta say, good on you, John. I listened to all that stuff Ben Weasel said on his horrible podcast, and it is so clear he is just a super bitter dude who feels like he never got his due in the 90s, like his peers, Green Day. Any guy who fights with Mike Park is just an asshole. He can couch and excuse all his shit as performance art, but that just goes to show how phony and disingenuous he is. This is second. We all know what former band Adam White is talking about, and I really love that band's first records. So the whole thing was just super disappointing to hear. I did get a chance to meet those guys before, and they were more interested in some girl behind the merch table than talking to us, the fans, so it's not terribly surprising that he might be kind of a dick. And then he said, Tricky Ricky's indignant attitude towards Hannah Montana was spot on, Jason in Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Jason. I just want to mention, before you continue, John, I've gotten support in the comments on Punk News and random people on Twitter.
Well, there you go. Ricky's getting support. And here's some more support for Ricky.
Yes.
This is from, let's see here. I got a couple of different emails. Okay, this is from a guy called Lucci. I think maybe that's an Hispanic name. He says, Hannah Montana is not punk. I don't know why he calls her Hannah Montana too. Hannah Montana is not punk. She shouldn't be on the Punk News podcast. She has nothing to do with punk rock. Large Jane Grace should not be playing with her. So there you go, Ricky. Some more support. Ricky, okay. Here's some more support from you from Wardy. Oh, no. Well, this is from Wardy. He says, I don't know why Wardy felt the need to send this over. This is W-A-R-D-I-E. John, you are probably the kind of asshole that likes the Steve Miller Band. I do like the Steve Miller Band. This email actually got me to want to listen to Steve Miller Band's greatest hits, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. No, this is the one that I was talking about with that supports Ricky. Let me dig this back up. Here we go. Ricky, this is from Brian. Guar is not punk. Miley is not punk. Please change the name of your website and podcast. Or maybe you should just learn what punk is. Because from what you post and talk about, you have no idea or no effing clue what punk is. And then he says...
Right. This is the whole long back and forth, right?
Yeah, well, I'm just going to read parts of it, yeah. So it's people like you who blur the lines because of an attitude that seems like punk, or just because someone does something themselves, you automatically throw a punk label on them. If that's the case, then your argument that every band is punk. Stop blurring the lines. Punk is a genre of music, period, from Brian. So there you go, Ricky. You've got a supporter. Miley Cyrus is not punk. And this is from Holly. Holly disagrees with Ricky. Holly says, I like that Laura Jane Grace played a concert with Miley Cyrus. I think it is a great way for pop people to hear punk and also hear a trans positive message. I think that it is cool that Laura Jane Grace did that and that Miley wants to do it too. Signed, Holly. So there
can
you
I
go.
Respond to Holly real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Holly, listen, if you remember in my rant, I didn't fault Laura at all for doing this. And I said, like, it was good that Miley was doing, using her fame to get the trans message out there. And John used the, Penny Rimbaud, David Beckham analogy for that. So you and I somewhat agree. It's where I have the problem where she just got in the way, you know, I don't like her interfering into the punk scene. And really, I think that was more of Laura being more of the activist than the punk rock, you know, fuck everyone musician kind of a thing. So I don't think we disagree too much on that. So we can probably meet in the middle there.
Yeah, I'm with Holly.
Well, there you go.
It's like everyone older than me is, and then people who are my age or something like that.
Well, like you said, she was more the activist than the fuck everyone musician. Which one's more important?
It depends. Like, well, I mean, I also said in the podcast, like, I would be horrified if there was like I had this. This like vision in the back of my head that I said that like I'm at an Against Me show and all of a sudden they say, hey, we want to bring up Miley Cyrus to do, you know, Walking Is Still Honest with us. And that would fucking horrify me if that were true and if that happened. So that's where I'd have a real problem with that. But I didn't have an overall problem with the video too much. I just have a problem with Miley in general. Just as a person and as an entertainer and as you know, you want to call her music, that's cool, but I don't really like to.
Yeah, I mean, it's garbage pop, but she's relatively innocuous as far as I'm concerned.
My only issue with Miley Cyrus is that if Miley Cyrus debuted as Miley Cyrus as an adult, I wouldn't even care about her. But it does trouble me that the way she became Miley Cyrus was through the avenue or the hook that we're sexualizing a former child star.
You know, oh, agreed. Agreed.
Well, if you look at the fucking all the people that came up in those Disney shows, like that live, I don't know, was it Mickey Mouse Club or whatever? I mean, like Britney Spears came up through that. I mean, Timberlake did. Timberlake came up through that. Wasn't there another one? Christina Aguilera, I think?
Yeah.
A bunch of them were in it.
And I mean, they didn't have a TV show, but they were, you know, they were stars as children in a way. And, and that's why you got to grow up sometime, John.
That's also why. But also, here's the thing: like Miley had literally a golden path for her. She not only was she on the Disney Channel, but her dad had that stupid fucking song in the '90s.
I owned the tape single.
There you guys go, Greg Simpson. He encourages the Disney kids to grow up. Adam Eisenberg is a huge Iggy Breaky Heart fan, and Ricky is anti Miley. This is from Jorge. Great podcast this week. Honestly, though, did you ever expect Ben Weasel to do an interview? He constantly goes on Facebook, insults people, and then blocks them before they can respond, including myself. He's afraid of conflict, and that's from Jorge. This is from Adam T. Everyone knows the band that Adam White was talking about. I saw them a few years ago. Adam T. So I guess we weren't as secret as we thought we were about that band. This is from Megan. The Ben Weasel podcast was great. What I like about Punk News is how you guys cause a ruckus once in a while. I always listen. Well, thank you for listening, Megan. This was an anonymous email sent to me. Oh, let me see if I can pull it up real quick. Oh, here we go. This is an anonymous message sent to me. Dude, why would you want to start an argument with Ben Weasel? It's just not worth it. So that's an anonymous email.
And you didn't start it, though.
Well, and we didn't really cause the ruckus either. We just said, hey, can we interview you like we do to, you know, all sorts of people all the time?
I mean, I'm not bragging here, but I've interviewed some fairly famous people throughout my writing career. I've interviewed Ice Cube. I've interviewed Rob Halford. None of setting up those interviews was nearly as complex or as convoluted as this. You know what I mean?
Agreed.
For Ice Cube, you write to his PR, does Ice Cube want to do an interview? And they're like, yes. And you interview Ice Cube. It's that simple, you know? Mm-hmm. Not that Ice Cube's the biggest guy in the world, but Ice Cube's Ice Cube. You know what I'm saying?
He's a fair bit bigger than Ben Weasel.
and rightfully so, mind you. Lastly, this is from Keith P. This one goes to Ricky from Keith P. I agree with Ricky. Miley is a poser, and I think she is part of an advertising scam. Signed, thank you. Keith P.
That was a big part of my rant, too. Thank you. That was also part of it. I thought it was also not necessarily a PR like scam or plot, but it was definitely like a PR insurance kind of a video, I thought. Thank you for all the support. I was a little nervous after that podcast.
Well, yeah, actually, not to drag this out, but so if you guys were Adam White was there, but I was saying to Adam White and Ricky, I'm like, man, how bad is this Rumble going to bet? How bad is this Rumble going to get? And it wasn't even that bad. The worst thing Ben Weasel did was go on Twitter and say that I was quote dumb. That's the baddest ammo he had.
You get called worse in the comments every day.
That's the thing. The trolls, which everyone knows I have a disdain for, were better arguers than he was. I was expecting a knockdown, drag out fight, but I guess just because our argument was so ironclad, he had nothing. That was it. He said, well, John's stupid. He didn't know what he's talking about. And I'm like, well, you agreed to do an interview and then backed out. And then he ran away. And that was it. So anyways, that chapter's over. I'm not going to mention Ben Weasel again unless he tells lies about me or Punk News. And I don't think he will. And that's fine. And that's the end of that chapter. Ricky, let's kick off a new positive chapter of the Punk News podcast. Let's put the badness behind us. Play a song. What do you got?
Okay, so I saw this band open for Bad Religion last year. They're called The Scandals. We've done some reviews on them, but I think they've been a little overlooked, at least on Punk News a little bit.
You know who did the very first review of The Scandals ever?
You. You.
Mm-mm, indeed.
Mm-mm. Okay.
Yes.
Say 10 Records is reissuing their first album called Sounds of Your Stereo. And it's being pressed on vinyl for the first time by the label. They have a bit of a Gaslight Anthem-y, Flatliners kind of a sound to them. Maybe a little bit more gruffer. If you haven't heard of them, they're from New Jersey. You can follow them at The Scandals on Twitter. They have you can see them on Facebook at facebook.com/NJScandals. And again, the album is called Sounds of Your Stereo, and the song I'm going to play from it is called Avalanche. So here's Avalanche by The Scandals.
Studied to listen, I studied.
And that was Avalanche by The Scandals. Ricky, what's that record label again? Say 10, and what's the release?
The release is their first album that came out in 2010 called Sound of Your Stereo.
And you can also check out their very first release out on Baldy Long Hair Records.
Really? No.
For real, yeah.
Really?
Really? Oh. Yeah. So anyways, let's kick off this week's podcast, Fest 14, of which Punk News is a sponsor. All the Punk News kids love Fest. It's a huge party every year down in Gainesville, Florida. Punk News is proud to be a sponsor. We got a lot of cool content coming up for you for Fest 13. This year, it is October 30th through November 1st, and I think pre-Fest is a couple of days before then. Fest 14 has just announced some new bands to this year's lineup. Modern Life is War, Title Fight, War on Women, Mass Intruder, Pet Sematary, Ninja Gun, The Dirty Nil. They'll be joining previously announced acts, including Lagwagon, The Menzos, Mustard Plug, Off With Their Heads, and many, many, many more. Adam E., probably the guy who's been to the Fest more than anyone else at Punk News, what do you think of these additions? Are you excited for Fest number 14?
I'm always excited for Fest. You know, the additions, I think, are some people probably expected, like Mass Intruder, War on Women, bands who have played before, both of whom I'm excited to see again. Modern Life is War, I know people are super excited about. I'll check that out. As Friends Rust is another one. Really important, kind of pioneering Gainesville post-hardcore band. Haven't really played much in years. One show here, one show there every couple years. So the fact that they're playing is a big deal for people. Bigwig is playing. And one band that got added I'm really excited to see is a band I know Adam White has played on this podcast before, the Steve Adamic Band from Ottawa. And they're a band that is from Canada and does not come to the States much. So it didn't really feel like I'd have a chance to see them anytime soon. So the fact that they're playing is pretty exciting. But yeah, I'm excited because I'm always excited for Fest.
Ricky.
Yes.
Have you ever been to Fest before? Are you excited for this?
I mean, I kind of, you know, every year that they announce the Fest lineup, I just kind of am drooling at the whole thing because of all the amazing bands. I mean, of the new additions, I got to tell you, War on Women just looks like that could be an amazing show, especially after that record that they just put out.
That band was just kicks ass, man.
They're really good. I remember like starting to listen to that album and being like, I actually said out loud, like, holy shit, this is awesome. And then also they sent me that condom. How can we forget that? When they sent me the physical copy.
See, how many bands are looking out for you like that?
Have you They're not. Used it yet, Ricky?
I purposely said I wouldn't because I wanted to keep it with the album as, you know, a quote unquote collectible.
Uh-huh. That's excuse.
Let me tell you, Greg. Tricky Ricky has no problem getting, I've seen it firsthand. I have seen women throw themselves at Tricky Ricky at a Narboot show. And let me tell you, there's not a whole lot. Well, actually, there are a lot of guys on a Narboot show.
Wait, the Narboot show?
Yeah, man.
Was it the one telling us to stay after Narboots performed?
You're getting involved with stuff I don't even know about.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Tricky Ricky. Listen, Greg.
It was such a wild night, he doesn't even remember it.
Tricky Ricky knows his way around the Mac and C, let me tell you.
Yep, I do.
Yep.
Who else has something to say about Fest?
Am I the only staffer who has never been to Fest?
No, I've never been to Fest, and I've never been to Fest.
I haven't either.
You guys should come to Fest.
It's just like I don't. For me, it's just the plane ticket, and it's like a lot for West Coasters to come out there for Fest.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I get to drive there, and that makes a big difference.
That is a huge convenience.
It is. Florida's really a terrible place to live, and I would leave it if it weren't for my Fest access.
Really? That's the only thing keeping you there?
It's one of...
Adam, what's the best set you've seen at Fest?
My God, that's like asking me to choose which child I love the most.
Don't you only have one child?
Well, yes.
And you still can't pick?
Yeah. He likes the dog the best.
It's hard to say. There are awesome sets that are awesome for different reasons. I mean, seeing Painted Black set up with a generator in the back of a U-Haul and play for like half a song until everybody just kind of converged on top of them and broke the generator, and then cops on horses showed up. That's a really memorable kind of thing. People were doing backflips off the top of the U-Haul. It was kind of insanity. I mean, seeing the Descendants play anywhere at any time is pretty awesome. There's been a lot. It's hard to say what the best one is. Some of the best sets are ones that, you know, you don't even really know what you're getting or know what to expect. Like, I saw Noise by Numbers play at 1:30 in the morning at this tiny place called 1982. And, you know, they're good. I expected a good show. Because it was 1:30 in the morning, everybody was just beyond bombed. And it was one of the most hilarious spectacles I've ever seen, independent of the songs they actually played. So, you know, there's a lot of memorable stuff that happens every year.
Hmm. Well, maybe I should finally make Fest 14 the year that I finally go. Gregor makes his appearance at the fest. I don't know. All right. Shall we move along?
Yes.
Major label BMG has purchased independent label Rise Records. The label was founded by Craig Erickson, who will still be with the company after the purchase. The financial terms were not disclosed. Teenage Bottle Rocket, Polar Bear Club, and 7 Seconds all recently released records on Rise. Laura Hubert, president of creative and marketing at BMG, Chrysalis US, stated, "Rise Records is more than a record label. It is a cultural phenomenon which has harnessed digital media to create a genuine community. We are delighted to partner with Craig and his team to give Rise's artists access to BMG's world-class admin services and international network." I'll tell you, that is some punk rock speak right there.
My world-class admin services.
Yep, I know. I'm clamoring for those admin services. I'll tell you.
You can't overstate a good admin service, let me tell you.
Oh, God. I mean, I it feels weird to say that Teenage Bottle Rocket's on a major label now.
That is weird, right?
Feels weird. That doesn't feel right.
It's like 1996 all over again.
Yeah, I mean, when I read this, I'm like, I wasn't like all up in arms, but I was just like, first of all, I want to know how much they acquired Rise Records for. I would love to know what the deal, the official number was. But do you think we'll get any fallout or any sort of band saying, nah, fuck this, and go, but like maybe Teenage Bottle Rocket going back to Fat because they're like, nah, we're not doing this? Or, I mean, I'd be interested to see who kind of leaves right after this deal is completely done. Anyone?
Yeah, I do think there is some danger for a band like Teenage Bottle Rock, because I think Rise Records' bread and butter is more like screamo bands in like, you know, like, yeah. Motley Crue circa 2014, essentially.
Yeah, but they also have Hot Water Music, I think, don't they?
Yeah, but I mean, compared to the screamo bands, Hot Water Music don't sell nothing.
It's, you know, it's sort of like the Epitaph model, where they have you know, that falling in reverse sort of stuff, and then they use the money they make from that to put out a Propaganda record. It seems like sort of like that. They put out the screamo stuff, they make some money, and then they're like, all right, we'll put out a Hot Water Music record.
Well, apparently the screamo stuff hasn't been making enough money if they, you know, sold the label.
No, that's just that it's making lots of money.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with
that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, do you think – how much do you think they paid for this? What, you think anything above $50 million?
No. I would say like 15, 12 to $15
million. Okay.
Yeah, I would say that's probably about right.
Well, it's kind of like the same old story, and luckily, and I wish the best for Teenage Bottle Rock and all the punk news homies, if you will, is the story is, you know, a label gets bought by another label, the people that cared for the band at the label leave or get laid off, and the new people have no emotional connection to the smaller bands, so the smaller bands just get wiped out, and, you know, the screamo bands stay on board. Luckily for Teenage Bottle Rocket and those kinds of guys, Craig, I forgot his last name,
Erickson.
Craig Erickson is still part of the company, so he kind of can act as protection. But also, I doubt that Rise Records signed Teenage Bottle Rocket for a 5-record deal. They probably signed him for a 2-album deal. So worst comes to worst, they put out one album that no one cares about, and then they move on from there. But on the other hand, well, yeah, I mean, that's my position is that BMG probably bought it for the screamo mallcore stuff, and I hate to use the phrase mallcore because it's not even really a thing anymore, but it sort of is, you know. And then they didn't buy it for like Hot Water Music, you know. So
interesting, huh?
So along the lines of, I guess, a more mallcore, if you will, this is pretty cool. Peter Hook of Joy Division and his band Peter Hook and the Light just recorded all of the Joy Division discography live on one night. They played the entire Joy Division discography at, I think it's called Christ Church or something like that. And they're, oh no, here we go. The Church's Conservation over in England. And they're releasing the whole set, which I think it's 3 CDs. Maybe it's 2 CDs. No, 3 CDs.
Triple.
Of yes. Live Joy Division stuff for a charity. I've seen Peter Hook play the Joy Division stuff live, and it's awesome. I mean, obviously, it's not Joy Division, but it's actually – it's a little bit more energetic, a little bit wilder, a little bit more punk rock. So it's Peter Hook with his phenomenal bass and that amazing sound doing revved-up versions of Joy Division songs. Bafflingly, though, Love Will Tear Us Apart is not on the live set. I have no idea why. I mean, maybe they just forgot to list it. But you would think they'd play like Joy Division's biggest jam. At any rate, I'm not saying everybody should buy this, but I would check this out. I've seen Peter Hook live. He's awesome. I'm probably going to buy this because the songs are not Joy Division. The song is Peter Hook playing Joy Division songs. So they're different, they're energetic, and they're frankly very exciting. So I really enjoyed that.
He's a cool guy. I actually just listened to a really good interview with him on the Sound Opinions podcast.
Oh, really?
Kind of how you were saying they're more energetic. He talks a lot about how kind of trying to demystify the whole Ian Curtis thing. Everyone, you know, kind of looks back on him as though he was just mopey, depressed guy. But Peter Hook, you know, kind of sheds this new light on him about how he was really energetic and he was really into the music and he wasn't just down in the dumps all the time. So I feel like maybe he kind of, Peter Hook, when he plays those songs, he kind of brings that side of Ian Curtis to the songs, just kind of amps him up and thinks about the good times rather than like, oh, these are songs that, you know, sung by my dead friend.
Yeah, there was an interview where he talked about that exact thing earlier. I think it was on this website called Punk News. And I think this guy called John interviewed him. I can't remember, but he's cool. Another old school. Actually, I'm going to throw this out to you guys. We're about to talk about PIL, Public Image Limited. What is the connection between John Lydon and Peter Hook? There's a fairly direct connection. Anybody?
No.
Is this the whole dude who would go on to be Joy Division at the Sex Pistols show story?
Exactly. Peter Hook, Ian Curtis, and Bernard Sumner were at the Sex Pistols famous Lesser Free Trade Hall show, where they were reportedly there. So there's your connection right there. Adam Eisenberg, Pill's putting out a new album. I like Pill. I think you love Pill. Are you excited for this? Did you like the last PIL album?
You know, I did. So the new album is called What the World Needs Now, and it'll be out in September on the 4th. And they do plan on touring. There are European dates up. You can find them at Punk News. North American dates to come. I did like the last Pill album. Actually, since Pill reformed a couple years ago now, I did very much enjoy the album. I've seen them twice. And yeah, I'm excited for this. I think they're doing very interesting stuff right now. You know, when they did reform originally, it was like, you know, is it a cash grab? What's it going to sound like? Is it going to be, you know, have the passion behind it? And I was impressed and thought it did. So, you know, I am looking forward to this.
Yeah, I'll check this out. When was the last time they put anything out?
Like 3 years ago.
Oh.
And I have the 12-inch EP. That came before, it actually is really good.
It is. You know, Pill started obviously as sort of the first post-punk band in that they took, you know, in many ways it was still a punk rock sort of approach, but they just did it a little differently. And, you know, over time they evolved into more of an 80s rock sort of thing later in their career. So when it came around to them coming back, it really was a big question about what they'd sound like. But, you know, it's a more simple sound than we heard when they went away the first time.
This is kind of a dumb question, but what do you guys think the Sex Pistols would have sounded like if they had recorded a second album?
I don't know. Did they have like the wherewithal to do it after? I mean, they must have been exhausted after the first one, seeing how it was like such a struggle.
Yeah, but I'm saying in my alternate reality world, they fire Malcolm McLaren and then they're friends again because Malcolm McLaren is gone and they decide to record a second album.
Well, is Sid alive or not?
Sid's still alive, okay. But he's as incapable of playing the bass as he was before.
That's what I was going to ask.
Is that junkie he was dating still around?
Or yes. No? Nancy's still around.
Or does she OD?
No, Nancy's still around. She does not OD, but Sid does have a severe heroin problem.
This is a ridiculous question.
I think they still break up then.
You think so?
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
I think they would do an EP. I don't think they'd get along enough to record enough songs to do a full album. It would just be like a 3-song EP, and then, like, you know, they just go their separate ways. And then what? They try and tour after that? I mean, that was a disaster the first time they came to the United States.
Well, that was Malcolm McLaren's fault. I really, really wish there was a good live Sex Pistols album from their original incarnation. I mean, there's good record. Well, there's good performances, but all the recordings are extremely shitty. So,
yes, this is true. So moving on here, Tau Cross, the band featuring Rob Miller of Amoebix, along with some other dudes from some pretty cool bands like Misery and Voivod, they're streaming their brand new album. I checked it out, and it's pretty good. It's out May 19th. That was yesterday in Punk News Podcast recording time. A couple days ago when you hear this. It's on Relapse. I thought it sounded pretty good. I know a couple of you other guys have thoughts about this. John?
Yeah, this album is really good. As you guys probably know, I'm a huge Amoebix fan. The main thing with Amoebix is that it's brothers Rob Miller and Stig Miller, and they really form the sound of Amoebix. Well, Rob and Stig aren't recording together right now, so this is Rob Miller and some other guys. So thankfully, they don't try to make it Amoebix 2.0. It's fairly different. It's almost like a thrash metal or just like a classic heavy metal record. I definitely dig it. I think Rob's on some of his best lyrics ever. He does a lot of metaphysical thought and questioning of, well, both the government and questioning of why do we believe the things that we believe. And what I think is super interesting is sometimes he scowls at humanity and says, how can you let yourself do the things you do? But then at the very end, he sort of reserves hope for humanity and thinks humanity can save itself, I guess. So, you know, it's a straight-up heavy metal record, more or less. It's got a lot of that ancient British pagan beliefs kind of veiled or weaved into the actual lyrics and music, which I love. And that's one of the things I really like about that. So let's take out a song from the band. Let's listen to Fire in the Sky, which is a badass track. So this is Fire in the Sky off the new Tau Cross album, out now on Relapse Records.
We'll be right back.
And we are back. We just talked about an Uber Punks band, Tao Cross. Let's talk about another Uber Punks band, Green Day. Green Day just played 924 Gilman, and it was actually a pretty big deal because they hadn't played. They played Green Day they played 924 Gilman in 2001 because they just jumped on stage and didn't tell anyone they were going to play, and they didn't play 924 Gilman before that until before 1994, 1993, 1995, something like that. The rule being that no major label bands can play 924 Gilman, so. Out of the blue, Green Day plays 924 Gilman. The reason was for a benefit show for AK Press in 1984 printing, which caught on fire. And I gotta give props to Rolling Stone. Punk News was the very first website to report on this because John G's got some connections, people. So John G knew about this as it was going down because, you know, John G, he knows this punk rock people. And so we were the first people to post this article. Rolling Stone saw it and posted it, but they gave us credit. So thank you very much, Rolling Stone. We appreciate that. A lot of other websites saw that we posted it, did not give us credit for having the inside scoop, but that's cool. You know, what can I say? When you're on top of the heap, people are just going to try to follow. What can you say? You know, there's leaders in the there's leaders and there's followers, Ricky. Leaders and followers.
Punk, I don't know why am I getting singled out for that?
I'm just saying. Anyway, so it actually sounds like, I mean, I'm not even a huge Green Day fan, but it sounds like it was a really cool night. Jesse Michaels of Operation Ivy did the flyers, which is cool. Jello Biafra introduced Green Day, and near the end of the set, Tim Armstrong got on stage with Green Day, and they played the cover of Operation Ivy's Knowledge. So, Greg, I'm going to throw this to you because you're a Green Day fan, and I think Ricky's a Green Day fan too, right, Ricky?
When I was like 13.
Well, I know Greg's an old school. I know Greg's an old school Green Day fan. Greg, first of all, is this cool? Is it cool that Green Day's repping their scene? Is it bullshit that 924 Gilman won't let a major label band play there except when they need something?
Well, yeah, I feel like that. Not letting a major label band play there. I mean, for one thing, logistically, like the place is like, what's the capacity on that?
About 250.
Yeah, so I mean, really, you can't do it for the most part. But I think that stance that they take is kind of like how people are throwing hate mail our way or your way, John, about like, oh, you're reporting on stuff that isn't punk. Like, this isn't punk. They're major label. They're not punk. They can't play here. I don't know. It's kind of silly just having that kind of hard and fast rule. But it does sound like it was a pretty cool event. I like that they seem to be trying to get back to their roots as much as a band with that big of a name can do. And it's cool to see that people from that scene and from that era are still down with them. You know, Tim Armstrong, he was at their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame performance as well. And yeah, Jello being there, it's like, you know, the punks, the true punks from way back, and they're still down with Green Day. So why can't we still be down with Green Day, right?
I have some questions here. Because, you know, I mean, I've only been there once, and I got to see one show about a year. Actually, it's almost been a year ago. Damn. They were very strict, and I asked the promoter of the show I went to about the rules on how you can play there and stuff like that. And he said like there's a whole like proportion, but to how much a band can be involved with a major label and distribution, and they have to have like 70% independent like distribution, something like kind of not arbitrary but kind of like ridiculous like that. And it seemed like a very close-knit community, and the fact that they keep those big major label bands out makes it special, and I think the guys in Green Day get that. My question though is, how in the fuck were they able to play? How were they able to circumvent these rules that they never bent, that 924 Gilman has never bent for anyone? On another note, I was watching some Twitter updates at people who were at the show, and apparently, why am I blanking on his name? The bassist for
Matt Freeman
was also there. So that was probably the closest you were going to get to an Operation Ivy reunion.
Dave Mello was nowhere in sight. Greg,
I don't know. But Greg, how did they circumvent those rules?
Well, Green Day's you know, their existence is largely responsible for, to some degree responsible for that place even still being open, for the notoriety that place has. You know, if there was no Green Day, nobody would have ever heard of Gilman.
Yeah, but
so, you know, I think if they want to play Gilman, they kind of get a pass.
Well, listen,
if they had asked a year ago or 2 years ago, hey, can we play Gilman? They wouldn't have done it.
Listen to this though, and this is, I mean, 924 Gilman's a cool place. I've been there many times. It's a great place to see shows. It's very good sound. And you know what? So I like it. I think they got a lot of arbitrary rules, which I think are stupid, which I really disagree with. I think their hearts in the right place, but I think they got a lot of stupid. Well, I think generally their hearts in the right place, but I think sometimes they pull the too cool for school card, you know. But listen to this, man. Green Day bought, like I think it's about 10 years ago. And Greg, you said it's cool that Green Day's getting back to their roots. Green Day really never abandoned, and I'm not even a huge. Somehow I find myself fighting on behalf of Green Day, and I'm not even a fan of the band. But Green Day never abandoned 924 Gilman. 924 Gilman abandoned Green Day, and here's how.
Yeah, yeah.
Like 10 years ago, Green Day said, oh, can we like give you guys a bunch of money or something, or we'll play a show? They're like, no, you can't play here. And they're like, well, can we just buy you a new sound system because your sound system's terrible? So Green Day bought Gilman like a $60,000 sound system.
Wow.
Yeah. There's other venues in town that Green Day has donated a lot of money towards to keep up. And I know they gave a lot of money to 1234 Gilman, 1234 Go Records to build them a stage and whatnot.
Nice.
And so Green Day really does help out a lot of those local bands.
They blew up, I mean, they kept their early stuff on Lookout. I mean,
yeah, and they didn't have to.
Still. Yeah, no, they didn't have to.
Yes,
but so that was nice, even though it didn't pan out. Anyway,
I have a feeling that had it not been for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, this wouldn't have happened.
Could be true, especially
which seems kind of like contradictory almost. Also, my other problem with 924 Gilman, even though I love the venue and everything, I don't like it when a 14-year-old's telling me I have to, like, giving me a hard time about how I have to buy a membership. I'll buy it. Just leave me alone.
Yeah, well, they're kind of – it's
membership?
You have to get, like, a two-year membership. It's only, like two extra bucks with the ticket.
It's two – the reason they do that, I think, is for, like, a legal thing. Like, so it's technically a club and not, like, a bar or whatever. I mean, they don't serve booze, but so it's technically a club.
Which I think they're a nonprofit too.
That might be it then, actually. But you get a lot of young kids in there, and so they start power tripping because they've never had power before. I remember one time Adam Davis of Gnarboots and I went in, and we had cans of iced tea, and this little 14-year-old kid says, you can't drink a 924 Gilman. And Adam Davis is like, it's iced tea, jackass. And we just walked right past him.
Yeah, you know? I mean,
and
I was
like,
I was like,
Adam Davis is so cool. He just walks around a 14-year-old.
I just don't get why, they don't employ people, but it's just like, I don't know. I just have a problem with someone who's like 10 years younger than me giving me shit about how I buy my ticket.
I have a problem with how comfortable they are with labeling what is and what is not punk rock. And honestly, yeah. I think it's self-defeating, and here's why. And not to bang on 924 Gilman too much, because they do have a lot of awesome shows. Okay. They do a lot of good stuff. But I think 924 Gilman is always asking for money. Always asking for money. So if they're constantly asking for money, maybe this utopia they have in mind isn't sustainable and it's destined to die. Maybe if you let like a Green Day like type band play there once every 3 months and just say, oh, it's like mega night, you know, or maybe if your rules weren't so strict as to what is and what is not punk, or maybe if you didn't insist on like putting like a million small bands that no one's ever heard of, which might be cool, but no one goes to check out because no one knows any of them, instead of some bigger names on there, you wouldn't be hurting for money all the time.
It just sounds like bad business.
They'd be like, well, 924 Gilman isn't a business, but they still have financial realities. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. So like, you don't have to be like, some like evil, CEO, like overcharging people, but just like, just make enough so you don't have to keep going back to the bands that blew up and started out there and asking them for money and handouts. It's a little sad.
Exactly. Not to drag this out too much. So, I mean, under the current 924 Gilman view, instead of being able to control their own destiny through fair and equitable pricing and staging of bands, they find themselves being beggars once every 6 months.
It's more than fair, though. That's the thing.
No, I don't think being a beggar every 6 months is more noble than having a business plan where you can support your ethics, but you're also able to sustain yourself. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a medium in there somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah, anyways. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about some bad brains. The bad brains.
They're not allowed to play 924 Gilman either.
Oh, are they not?
They are not. Bam.
It's because of stuff HR has said.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. In a recent interview with New Noise magazine, Dr. No of the Bad Brains has announced plans to record a new EP. Can you guys hear my cat meowing?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Shut up, Frank. At the end of May, the Bad Brains will record in Woodstock, New York. For the recording, the vocalist spot will be filled by Jesse Royal, a young Jamaican singer. The band will write and record the album in one day in front of an audience of 60 to 70 people. The session is part of a series of similar recording sessions called the Woodstock Sessions. Yeah.
When I typed this up, I was I didn't realize that – this is going to sound stupid, but I didn't realize that Jesse Royal was the Jesse Royal. Jesse Royal is actually a very large Jamaican singer. He's a very popular singer in Jamaica. Jamaica's kind of weird – well, not weird, but artists can be huge in Jamaica, but no one knows about them anywhere else. Jesse Royal is one of the biggest, most famous singers in Jamaica right now. So the Bad Brains – working with Jesse Royal is actually almost like a bigger deal for them than it is for Jesse Royal. Because, honestly, he does not need to be recording with the Bad Brains. He's huge in Jamaica. He's a, I guess you would call modern roots with a little bit of dance hall singer. So, you know, they're going to write it and record it in one day. It's not going to be like shouting hardcore punk. It's going to be like three or four reggae tracks. And I think it's cool that they're recording with Jesse Royal. I love the Bad Brains, but I think the dream is over, boys. I think I'm more interested in the Regulators, which is John Joseph, Dr. No, Daryl, and Mackie Jason, than I am of whatever Corpse's version of the Bad Brains are. I love the Bad Brains. Those early Bad Brains recordings are some of the greatest music ever recorded, but I think it's time to pull out the respirator on the brain, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, agreed. Well, we'll see how this goes, I suppose. Yeah. But yeah, it's the hardcore stuff that I like. I mean, the reggae stuff's fine.
Oh, I like the reggae stuff too. But I mean, they don't have the firepower. They don't have the firepower or the soul they used to have, you know. But speaking of a band that does have some firepower, Pairs, a band that one of the people on the podcast tonight has been championing for quite a bit. They've joined Fat Record, which is, you know, a pretty big record label. They just signed with Fat Record. They've got supposed to put out a new album in 2016 on Fat Records. They're going to tour until then. And Fat Record is also going to be releasing Pairs Go to Prison, which I think will be like the third or fourth label for that record. Ricky.
Yeah.
You were there at the beginning. Were you not?
I was. And I just like to pat myself on the back and say I was the only one here that put Go to Prison on his top 20 list of 2014. Number three. Yes, I thought it was better than the Pup album, better than Lagwagon. These guys fucking kick ass, okay? And really, and they've been moving insanely fast for a band. I heard them first on Anxious and Angry, Ryan Young's podcast, it was either July or August. And then and they just started touring like crazy. Ryan Young has pressed the album on Anxious and Angry twice now. And now I think they're going to be at Fest. They're playing punk rock bowling. They've been blowing up quite a bit. They're currently touring with Red City Radio and Strung Out. And I think everyone – I was surprised at how fast they got onto Fat Records. I don't think there's any question that this isn't a perfect fit. Like this is a band that can definitely do extremely well on Fat Records. And both, if you haven't checked them out yet, like you should really check out Go to Prison. It's really, really fucking good. And I'll be seeing them later this month. I had one other thing to say. Fucking called it. That's all. I knew this was going to happen.
I'll be the first to admit that I heard people talking about this band for at least a year or so.
And the thing is, Adam,
I never bothered to listen to them.
The thing is, they've only been a band for about a year. That's what's so crazy about this story.
So I finally listened to them today, and I'm impressed. They're quite good. I'm definitely going to check that record out. But that is interesting to know that you know, almost immediately upon formation, people started talking about them.
Yeah. And so Fat is also going to be repressing the album. I'll probably get the reissue on Fat. And then for those of you who don't know the band that well, there's also a 3-song demo EP that they have on their Bandcamp that I also reviewed and really enjoyed. It's kind of cool to listen to Go to Prison and then that EP, because you can see like where they were going. And there wasn't a whole lot that changed, a little bits and pieces. But I even said in my review that I kept finding something new every time I listened to them. And they've just, and like little Easter eggs that are like dedicated to like Descendants or Suicidal Tendencies. John or Greg, have you listened to Go to Prison? And if you haven't, you're bad people.
I have listened to it a couple of times. I'm kind of reminded every once in a while through punk news. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I should listen to that again. I wasn't totally won over immediately. And I'll say that there are parts of their songs where they really nod to like that classic Fat Wreck sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the skate punk stuff that I loved, like Lagwagon and Propaganda and that kind of really speedy, but clean stuff. Then there's other times where they stray a little bit away from the stuff that's in my wheelhouse. But there's enough that keeps me hooked, and I'm starting to come around more to the other parts. So I say I'm slowly becoming a fan.
What cool. is a wheelhouse? I've heard that phrase, but what is a wheelhouse?
Is it like I don't know.
Something, it's like your strong suit, so to speak. It's like,
no, I mean, I guess you'd say, what it is metaphorically, but I mean, what is it literally? What is a wheelhouse?
I don't know. Is it like the old mill that has the river running by? You got the water wheel.
And it's yes, that's actually that is exactly what a wheelhouse is.
But how does that make like the phrase means? Is it something like if it's in your wheelhouse, it means it's in your repertoire, your ability to do things. Like it's like, so John, you know, do you like hardcore? Yeah, it's in my mill grinding location. Like, how does that make any sense whatsoever? Anyway,
down at the old mill. I have no idea.
Ricky asked me, he said, John, have you heard the new Pears record or the old Pears record? Ricky, you forget. Pears is on the Punk News My Org mixtape, which I've just been informed is due to be shipped to me at the end of this week or early next week. So we'll be mailing that out very soon.
Yeah, nice. Man. I saw that email. I was excited.
So, but John, what do you think of the band so far then?
I like them a lot. They're not my very favorite band, but I think they kick ass for sure, and I would definitely see them live.
I cannot recommend their live show enough. They were insanely good.
What I think is that they take hardcore, but they make it very snappy and very energetic and rocking. There's a hook to it, so it keeps me excited. And there's undulation in it, is what I'm saying. So it's very dynamic and very exciting, so you follow along with it instead of getting bored by it. So I really did enjoy that record.
Right, so what everyone else is very excited about, especially today, is Ceremony releasing the L-Shaped Man LP. Ceremony are streaming it, the L-Shaped Man, in its entirety on KEXP. The record is due out, today, or was it yesterday?
Yesterday.
It was yesterday. Yesterday on Matador Records, and you can listen to the stream on the
Punk News
article,
yeah.
On the Punk News link. And I got to tell you, I know we talked about Ceremony quite a bit in the recent episodes. And I just want to say, John, when you talked about the Rohnert Park EP, I bought it. And that is not a record. That is a journey. That album is really, really good. So much so that I actually bought the sick 7-inch too, because that album just – fuck, it's good. It's really all I've been listening to for a while, for the last like week or two. But this, I want to hear from everyone else. Adam, I know you did you review this?
I did.
Nice. So why don't we start with you?
I will say really quickly on Rohnert Park, I don't like to speak in absolutes, but it is quite possibly the best punk rock record of the last decade or so.
It's definitely I think it's a perfect record. I would go as far as saying
that. I would definitely put in my top 10 without a question. That Ronette Park album is banging.
It is fantastic. That said, the L-Shaped Man sounds pretty much nothing like it.
No, not at all.
If you heard the follow-up to Ronette Park, which was called Zoo, definitely a departure from the heavier hardcore of their earlier records into a lot more post-punk. This album, The L-Shaped Man, takes it a little bit further. It's simply put a record influenced heavily by Joy Division. But, you know, Ceremony puts their own spin on it in a way that it maintains their personality through it, and that did impress me about the record quite a bit. Have any of you listened to it?
Yeah, I listened to this quite a bit. I'm a huge Ceremony fan. I actually, believe it or not, the first time I ever even heard of them really was at the Ronette Park record release show. I was so blown away. I bought all their stuff right there. That was an amazing show. So I've been a mega fan since the day Ronette Park came out. So I guess I'm really kind of a catcher on or a poser because I didn't even know about them for the first two records. I dug this record. I think this record's cool. I really like the sound. I wish they got a little bit trippier or weirder on a couple of the tracks. All the songs kind of have the sort of the same structure, like I guess the same tempo, the same sort of vocals. I wish they put in some weird instrumentals or some different times or some dramatically weird things. Kind of like, I almost wish as though they had brought in somebody like Brian Eno circa 1978 as a producer just to weird the whole thing up, and I think it would have been a lot more exciting. That being said, I dug the record, but I still haven't decided with myself, does it bite on Joy Division too much?
I just listened to half of this record today in preparation for this. I haven't gotten through the whole thing, but yeah, to me it feels like the way it's a lot more open than their old stuff. There's a lot more room for those lyrics to come through, and the lyrics aren't quite up to what I would Joy Division, the lyrics there. A lot of the lyrics at the beginning of this record, not cringeworthy. I guess they weren't that bad.
Really? I think they make you pretty good on this record.
Yeah, I don't know. They seem kind of pedestrian to me. Maybe I need to go back and listen again. But to me, I think going in with everyone like Joy Division this, Joy Division that, and I'm a huge fan of Joy Division, and lately I've been listening to a lot of them, and then so I put this on, and it's like you just set the bar way too high in that realm, and they didn't quite meet it.
See, I think I might be the only non-Joy Division like fan here.
I don't really have any particular excitement about Joy Division.
Yeah,
really?
I don't hate them. I just like, I get why they're important and stuff like that, but like I couldn't get into them. I tried listening to the other Ceremony albums, the ones before Ronette Park. I'm on the Ceremony train at Ronette Park, and then like that's it. And this album included, I just couldn't really get into it. I'm not saying it's like horrible, like Miley Cyrus horrible, but it didn't move me like Ronette Park did.
Well, you know, to put that in perspective, actually, when Ronette Park came out, all the people who loved Still Nothing Moves You, the previous album, they freaked out. And they were like, really? Ceremony's gone soft. They're not a power violence band anymore.
That's not a soft
sellouts.
Record at all.
They're weak. Yeah, it was a huge argument and honestly kind of absurd.
And I kind of when I started listening to their other albums and their discography, I kind of saw like, okay, they are clearly have a plan, a trajectory plan of where they're going to be. So that's why I'm not like disappointed in the album. I kind of just expected this to happen, especially listening to the first couple singles that they put out before the album was out. I have a question though. What's it going to be like at one of their shows when they play like Sick or Back in 84 from Ronette Park and then go into Your Life in France?
I know the exact answer.
That's going to be weird. Isn't that not going to be weird?
Well, according to Scotty Tancrimes, basically they come out, they do the new stuff, and people kind of stand there and focus, kind of like an indie concert. And then for the second half, they break into the old school stuff and people go nuts. Oh.
I saw them after right after Zoo came out. I saw them a couple times after Zoo came out, and you know, and those songs aren't quite as slow as these, the ones from Zoo. But there were even similar questions then, and they still like blow the doors off. I mean, I've seen them open with Sick, and everybody just goes insane, and for like three or four songs, then they'll slow it down a little, then they'll speed it back up again. But yeah, it seems like lately they're playing this stuff early and then kind of picking up the tempo at the end.
That's gonna be like a really like almost a polarizing, sound wise, kind of a concert if they decide just to mix it all together.
I think they'll do the slow first, slow stuff, and the fast stuff, which I think is a cool way to do it.
I just hope it comes close enough to me so I can see it.
I've got tickets. But what I say is, I gotta say, man, I gotta come out swinging for Sarah. I'm surprised by Ricky and Greg's hesitant reaction. I gotta come on stronger for this. I dig this record. I mean, I was saying maybe it bites on Joy Division too hard, but if that's everybody's attitude, man, I think this record's really good. I think it's one of the better punk records this year. I definitely think it's dark and it's heavy and it's difficult to do that. But I think they did it really well. But we should mention Ian Cohen's Pitchfork interview. I mean, not Pitchfork review. If the Punk News listeners haven't read Ian Cohen's Pitchfork review, you should. You should read Adam E's review at Punk News, which is an extremely well done review and seems to be in line with what most people are thinking. AV Club and Rolling Stone and other publications seem to be on line with Adam E. Ian Cohen basically just said he hated the record, and he didn't even really say why. He's like, this sounds like Joy Division. I hate it. I love Joy Division. This is not Joy Division. I hate it. And I don't know, like, Adam, did you have any perspective on that review or that perspective in general?
You know, I think as the reviewer, your job is to put all of that aside and, look at the music objectively. I mean, context is important, but you got to judge the music at face value to some degree when you review a record. And, you know, to me, I mean, if you asked me my personal opinion, given all the options, would I want Ceremony to keep making Rohnert Park over and over again? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. Because I don't think you want a band to, you know, to not strive to move forward artistically. Although it was a great record. That said, I just feel like it doesn't seem like it's that fair of a shake, and that bugs me. I think, you know, Pitchfork's attitude tends to be, we get it and you don't. You know, we have this superior ability to interpret artistry that you don't understand. And I just don't think that's a good perspective to come from when you're looking at art, honestly. It's snobbery at its worst.
Mm-hmm. I think he didn't give. I guess he was actually. It definitely seemed like he had an agenda on this review. You know, you can usually. I mean, as a reviewer myself, you can usually pick up when other reviewers have an agenda. So it definitely seemed like he had something personally against the band, or just wanted to smash them because everybody else is kind of pro Ceremony lately. But the review was well written in that it can't be disproven. Like if he said Ceremony, you know, isn't good at playing, you know, slow, heavy music, you could say that's not true. They're awesome at it. But basically, in his review, he just describes them and just says he doesn't like it. So it's kind of a dickish move, and it shows that he's got an agenda. But from a tactical standpoint, it's well done, and I think that's why Pitchfork, back in the day, more so than now, Pitchfork's kind of all right now, I think, more or less. But back in the day, Pitchfork used to infuriate people because they would take the position of, here's what it sounds like, and I think that's stupid. You know what I mean?
I can honestly say until I got onto the staff of Punk News, I never read Pitchfork. I only read the reviews on Punk News before. Well,
that's called your true punks, Ricky.
So yeah, I only read Pitchfork when somebody makes me.
Well, I actually read Pitchfork every day, honestly.
Yeah, same here.
Anyways, speaking of true punks, let's Adam E, man, listen. Adam E, you and I are pro-Ceremony. Not these two nudniks over here that says, I don't like Joy Division. Oh, you don't like Joy Division either. But not these two nudniks over here that say, I don't like Ceremony's new record. Adam E, hit him with a tune. Show him how great the new Ceremony is.
All right, I'm gonna play a track from the new Ceremony. This one's called The Bridge. It actually comes near the end of the record. It's a deep cut if you will. So this is from the L-Shaped Man, which, as we said earlier, is out on Matador Records now, in stores, online, etc. This one's called The Bridge.
Inside the bridge, you suddenly felt calm. Simply passing through the world. And remember the man with the wooden arm. How hard it must have been. How hard. You saw yourself walking with no one else. Just asleep at night. No dreams at all. No dreams at all. It's nothing like you ever thought.
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 It's nothing. Is it the feeling of heavy loss? You don't think about her anymore, but you still lie. You still lie. Going out and finding other things, it didn't hurt. It didn't.
Was The Bridge by Ceremony off the L-Shaped Man, out now on Matador Records. As promised, as the people have demanded, the people have said, John, we want to hear more about Amnesia Rockfest. Well, here's an interview I did with Amnesia Rockfest founder Alex Martell about Amnesia Rockfest. We talk about Amnesia Rockfest. We talk about the first one. We talk about the upcoming one. We talk about the time he went to Disneyland with Tim Armstrong. This is my interview with Alex Martell of Amnesia Rockfest. Oh, hey, Alex. How you doing? Thanks for doing the interview. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
You know, a lot of the Punk News kids are actually really into Amnesia Rockfest, so I'm glad we're getting to do this. Let's go back in time a little bit. I think a formative year for you, or formative festival for you, was when you went to see Ozfest out in Pennsylvania. Tell us a little bit about that festival and what that meant to you.
Well, just to give a little background, basically I grew up in Montebello, which is in the middle of nowhere. So there was really never any concerts or festivals or anything for that kind of music around here. So I always had to travel a lot and, you know, have my parents drive me to shows and that type of thing. And And yeah, Ozzfest and a bunch of other events like that were like some of the first shows that I've been to. And, you know, I've always loved the vibe of festivals, basically. And when I was a kid, there was like this big, it's kind of like the 4th of July here, but for Quebec. So there was like these big parties at the marina, which is where we do the Rockfest now. And I just remember as a kid that, you know, there was such a cool vibe with that particular area, that it would be so cool to do something there that for, you know, more rock-oriented music. So I guess all those things together kind of gave me the idea to start it.
And what's the first concert that you went to?
The first one that I remember was probably Slaves on Dope,
which
is a band from Montreal. They've been around since like the early 90s. I think that was the first one.
When you went to that show, like, was your mind blown wide open when you were like, oh my God, I can't believe this is what live music is like? What did that formative show mean to you?
I really remember that I was, you know, super excited, like, because at that point I was already a huge music fan, but I had never been able to go to shows yet. And I just really remember that I almost felt like puking beforehand just because I was so stressed and excited by it. And I just remember going in the crowd, and when, you know, the whole crowd started, you know, jumping up and down and, you know, moshing and all that stuff. Like, I remember at first I was really scared, but then I just, you know, instantly connected with that kind of thing. And, you know, from that point on, I just, you know, kept going to more and more concerts.
Now, I know you've told the story before, but we should just tell it again just so the Punk News audience knows it. Did you form, and Amnesia Rockfest is 10 years old this year. Now, did you form the festival out of necessity? Did you form it just because you wanted to run your own festival? Why did you decide to start a music festival?
Well, I guess the first reason is, you know, as I said earlier, the fact that there was just nothing going on in the area here. So I thought it would be cool to do something. Also, I was in a band, and, you know, we were pretty shitty at that point, so no one would book us. So I just figured, you know, I'll do my own show so I can book my own band. And, you know, I was actually the first band to open the first edition of Rockfest. So that was another reason. And I guess also the fact that, you know, I really wanted to get involved in music. Like, I didn't want to just sit there and consume it. You know, I wanted to really be a part of it. And I started helping out a bunch of local bands, especially with the promotion side of things. And, you know, these shows were just filling up really quickly. And same thing when I started college. Like, we had to do these shows for the local radio station as fundraisers. So I would just, like, you know, put up posters everywhere around town, and, you know, these shows were packed. So I just figured, you know, maybe I have some kind of talent to do this. So, you know, why not start this festival in my hometown? So I guess it was kind of a mix of all these things together.
And what band were you in back then?
It was called Deadly Apples. And, you know, we haven't been active in like 5 years because Rockfest is just taking up all my time. It's really not punk rock, though. It's more kind of like Nine Inch Nails type of music.
Okay, well, fair enough. Now this is the 10th anniversary of Amnesia Rockfest, so it's kind of a big deal. And Slaves on Dope are playing, again, the very first band that you saw live, that you remember seeing live, is playing the 10th anniversary. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it's pretty cool. Like, I invite them at Rockfest almost every year because I've known them forever. And Actually, their first reunion show was at Rockfest, I think maybe 5 years ago. And their singer is actually a big radio guy now at CHOM in Montreal. And, you know, he always helps out, you know, by talking about Rockfest. So I just think it's really cool, you know, to have these old friends at the festival. And another good example like that is a local band called Yuko, which played the first edition of Rockfest. And they're here again 10 years later. So I think that's really cool.
Now, this year, you got some really cool bands playing. You got Slayer, you've got the Melvins, you've got the Cro-Mags playing. You've got some really, really cool bands playing this year. You've got the Descendants playing, which is pretty crazy. All's playing. Michael Graves is playing. GBH. Those are all, like, really great bands. My question is, when do you personally curate the festival? Like, do you say, I want this band, that band, and this band? Or is it more of a committee type thing? How do you go about deciding who's going to play Amnesia Rock Fest?
Well, I'm basically the one that does it. Like, there's no committee. And I listen a lot to what the festival goers ask us. And, you know, I guess I'm kind of I'm good at listening to what they want. And, you know, I try to interact as much as I can on Facebook and everything. The difference this year is that Fat Mike and Tim Armstrong came on board as guest curators. So that was really cool, you know, just kind of exchanging ideas with them. And I think it kind of gives an extra depth to the lineup.
Yeah, let's talk about both of them, because that's kind of a big deal. Now, first of all, with Tim Armstrong, you and he went to Disney World like last year, the year before, right?
Yeah.
What did you guys do in Disney World? Did you guys go in Small World? Did you go on the Haunted House Drop? what did you and Tim Armstrong do in Disney World?
Well, it was actually at Disneyland in L.A. I became friends with Tim over the years. And so, you know, we usually hang out when I'm in L.A. And I was actually with my girlfriend, too, who really loves Disney. And Tim actually introduced me to a friend of his that was, I forget his exact title, but he's like one of the big guys at Disney. And basically we just kind of met up there. So it was really cool. We're actually trying to get a picture with Goofy, and the guy just wouldn't stop for us for the picture. So it kind of became an inside joke afterwards that Goofy is a rock star dickhead because he wouldn't stop for me and Tim Armstrong to take a picture.
Was Tim Armstrong like really into one aspect of Disneyland? Was he really into a ride, or was like Goofy his favorite character? I'm just curious.
Well, actually, I didn't do any rides with him while we were there. I spent most of the day with my girlfriend, and then we met up with him and his friend from Disney and had dinner there. Okay. And
Enough. You know, Mike of NoFX is curating, I think it's called the Tony Sly stage, which is, I mean, I don't want to say that's cool, but I guess it's well done, if you will, because I think Tony Sly played the last No Use for a Name show at Amnesia Rockfest. So I'm just curious, what was it like working with Mike of NoFX? What does the Tony Sly stage mean to you? What does Tony Sly mean to you?
Well, I guess the fact that, you know, the last No Use for a Name show was at Rockfest, it really had a big effect on, you know, everyone at the festival, and I think all the festival goers as well, because punk rock, like, is so big in Quebec, and people love it so much. So it just really had a big effect, a big impact on everyone. So to us, it was clear that we would name the new stage that we added the following year, the Tony Sly stage, which I think, you know, our festival goers really appreciated. And I know that Mike really appreciated it, and I know that it's really touched him, you know, because we could just sell that stage to a sponsor or whatever, but you know, it was something that was important for me. So we just left it like that. And I think Mike is a great guy, you know. I kind of think that people often focus on, you know, his antics or his goofiness or whatever, but, you know, he's really a smart guy and a smart businessman. And I think that's an aspect of him that I can really appreciate.
Alex, do you have about 5 more minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay, great. Now, actually, I think you have Propagandhi playing this year, and I think it's called the No Sponsors stage. I'm just curious, is that something Propagandhi asked for, and you said, okay, Propagandhi, we'll do that for you, or is that an idea you had, and you said, Propagandhi, you want... What's the purpose behind that? I'm curious. What's the statement?
Well, they don't usually play festivals because they don't like sponsors. So I just really wanted to find a creative way to convince them to play Rockfest because I think it's a great fit. So the idea that I came up with was to add an opening night on the Thursday on the Tony Sly stage and just have, you know, no sponsors involved and just call it the Fox Sponsors opening night. So I came up to them with that concept and, you know, they liked it. And, you know, it was a little bit of back and forth to kind of find the exact formula. But I'm really happy that it worked and that they're actually playing the festival. I think it's going to kick it off pretty well.
Oh, well, that's pretty clever. You know, I'm a big Jello Biafra fan, and a couple of years ago or last year, there was kind of a thing with Jello where he had to pull out because the Dead Kennedys were playing. I mean, did you understand Jello's perspective? Were you angry at him, or was there no hard feelings? I'm just curious about that.
Well, definitely no hard feelings on my end. I mean, I'm a fan of Jello too, and I'm also actually a big Ministry fan, and I love the work that he's done with Al Jorgensen. So it was kind of weird when he, you know, when he basically talked about us in the press. Basically, we were just trying to do something really cool, you know, having on the same lineup stuff like, you know, Misfits and also Danzig with Doyle on the lineup, you know. But obviously, we put them on different days, so there wouldn't be any issues. And we did the same thing with Black Flag and Henry Rollins. And the idea was to do the same thing with Dead Kennedys and Jello Biafra. But apparently, when he found out, he wasn't happy about it. But I think there was a miscommunication because what he said in that interview was that he thought they would be playing the same day, but we had actually booked them on 2 separate days. So I'm not sure what happened there, but, you know, we'd love to have him at the festival eventually, and we'll make sure not to book Dead Kennedys the same year. So, so it's fine with him.
Well, wrapping up the interview, you know, you mentioned Ministry. I think it's real cool that you've got Ministry and Skinny Puppy. That's cool. You know, some industrial, some goth stuff. Last question, Alex. Who are the picks for this year? Who should we go check out this year? Who are the bands to see this year?
There's so many. I'm super happy about Refused. I think that's really going to be a great one. We're bringing lots of bands from Sweden this year. So aside from Refused, you know, stuff like Satanic Surfers that I somehow managed to convince to reunite. Raised Fist, No Fun At All, Randy, and who else? There's like so many. I could go on and on forever.
Well, fair enough. Well, Alex, thanks so much for the interview. I know the Punk News kids are going to be so happy with this interview because a lot of the Punk News kids, the Canadian kids, are really in the Amnesia Rock Fest. So thanks again, and you got a lot of killer bands in the lineup, so I appreciate it. So nice talking to you.
Yeah, well, likewise, and thanks for the support. I love your website. It's one of the ones that I check out on a daily basis. So,
well, thank really you very cool. much. Well, Alex, thanks again, and best wishes to you. Bye-bye. And we are back, and that wraps up tonight's Pung News Podcast. Boys, I think it was a pretty action-packed episode tonight. What do you think?
Oh, nothing beats the one from last
week. Well, that was a rumble. And you know, honestly, like there's that quote in Godfather Part Two, I think, where he's like, a war is good every once in a while because it gets out all the bad blood. So I'm glad we had a bit of a rumble last week, and now we're back to, you know, kind of just chilling and grilling, having a peacey, good old, jolly good time.
Well, you know, I think that's appropriate because we also learned this week that Ricky is a big Grateful Dead fan.
Oh, that was such a dick move, John. That was such a dick move.
So the Pump News listeners, listen to this. On Facebook, like if your friends are a fan of like, I don't know, like Wendy's, it'll say Adam Eisenberg likes Wendy's. You should like Wendy's too.
I most certainly do not like Wendy's.
Well, whatever that, you know. I said Adam Eisenberg likes Starbucks. Then you should too, you know. So I saw like I've got, I don't know, I think like 300 friends on Facebook, maybe more, and it said Ricky Frankel likes the Grateful Dead, and like none of my other friends like the Grateful Dead. And so I screen grabbed it and showed it to the Punk News posse in the Punk News Hovercraft office. So Ricky Frankel's a deadhead. I think we should fade out with a Grateful Dead song. I'll let Greg Simpson pick what Grateful Dead song we should fade out.
It should be Ripple.
There you go. Ricky's picking the deep cuts. Thanks again.
Right? I don't know that one.
You can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. And be sure to tune in next week, Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. for our live episode 250. It's just going to be a chilling out podcast. Ricky's going to bring some, you know, Grateful Dead tunes. We're going to chill out. And, you know,
John, here's the thing. You like them too. I saw the status.
So anyways, what a long, strange trip it's been. Keep it groovy. We'll see you next week.